You ain't heard nothing yet.
Turn around, little
bitch. What am I going to do?
Frankly, my dear,
I'm going to make him an offer.
You talking to me?
No! I am not entertained!
I don't know who you are.
Why so serious?
When I'm good, I'm very good.
Simple.
But when I'm bad, I'm better.
He's a liar!
Snap out of it!
Call me Mr.
A boy's best friend is his mother.
You have no style.
You can bark all day, little dog.
No!
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
Hello, and welcome back to the Tinsel Factory. My name is Caitlin, and I'm your host. Happy Oscar Sunday to all who celebrate. Today is my Super Bowl. I'm going to make polenta and I'm very excited. As far as the rest of this week, on Thursday, I went to a producer's Q&A for the Best Picture nominees, which was awesome. I finally drug my coworkers out to trivia to show off how much worthless knowledge I have. And today I'm heading out after I record this to hang out with my friend and her baby for one of the baby's first adventures out into the world, which should be interesting. Hopefully he's very social, so I think he'll be good, but we'll see. This week on Movie Theater Movie Reviews, we've got To Kill a Tiger, Robot Dreams, and The Boy and the Heron. To Kill a Tiger is an Oscar-nominated documentary this year about the lengths a man in rural India goes to get justice for his daughter, including risking his entire life and everyone he's ever known. To Kill a Tiger was an intense, important look into the rights of women and their bodies outside of the Western world, and just how bad the world can be for some women and young girls. It was horrific to see and to hear what some people, like how some people victim blame. Wasn't surprising. It was kind of like when I talked about Io Capitano last week. It was disappointing to see, but not surprising at all. There's no way to even call this movie good or bad for me, this documentary for me. It's just super important. It's an important film to see, and it covers a very crucial humanitarian topic. Then there's Robot Dreams, which is nominated for Best Animated Feature. I saw this about 2 hours after I saw To Kill a Tiger and figured that it would cheer me up after, you know, watching a really serious, devastating documentary. I didn't see a trailer of it. I saw a little bit of maybe a little clip, a little blurb here or there, and I saw images of the movie. I knew nothing about it. Based on the pictures I saw, I thought it was going to be a cute dog and robot movie, and boy, was I wrong. This film is about being separated from a loved one and how to cope when a relationship changes irrevocably and how you move on, which was not something I was mentally prepared to handle at that point in the day because I was still recovering emotionally from the last thing I had just seen. So yeah, I was very, very sad after both of those movies. Robot Dreams was very creatively told. There's no dialogue, which makes it feel like more universal and its message. The one good thing is afterwards, the film's director came out for a Q&A, and he's clearly having the time of his life being nominated for an Oscar and getting to do all this stuff. I mean, obviously, I would be stoked too. So he did fix my mood after that because he just came out. He was like tap dancing. He was so excited. He's very passionate about this film. You can tell he absolutely loves how it turned out, which is always a nice thing to see. But yeah, that one, be prepared to be emotionally kind of struck despite what the film looks like visually. Then finally, we've got The Boy and the Heron, which is the first Miyazaki film I think I've seen during its initial theatrical run. Overall, I thought it was great, but the last Miyazaki film I saw was Spirited Away for the first time, and I just don't know how you beat that one. This one, while gorgeous and amazing and creative, just didn't capture the same magic for me that Spirited Away did. But from what I've seen maybe a third of his films. From what I've heard, like Spirited Away is like the apex, but it's hard not to compare this one to that because it's very similar. And like, it's like what happens storytelling wise. Don't get me wrong. It was a great film. It's just I've seen stronger storytelling from Miyazaki in the past. So with seeing these three movies in theaters and doing other streaming and other stuff, I have officially for the first and I swear to God, last time ever, despite my friends going, you're going to do this next year. You know you are. I'm not doing it. I have seen every single nominated film, every film that's nominated for an Oscar this year. There are 53 of them. Admittedly, 15 of them are shorts, but I have seen all 53 films nominated for an Oscar. And I'm exhausted. It was way harder to do than I thought it was going to be, but I do feel mad accomplished about it. I'm not going to lie. I also have very strong opinions. I discovered last night when I was helping a friend of mine fill out her Oscars like ballot for like guessing like for an Oscar pool game. I was like, oh no, I'm informed to give opinions on every single one of these. And I've never had that before. I'm like, well, I've seen like two of them. I like this one more than this one, but I don't know about the other three. And this year I'm just like, no, it should be this. It's going to be this. It's a set of knowledge that I acquired not realizing I'd done so until it was too late and I already had the knowledge. I don't know what you do with this knowledge after today. I'm sitting here Saturday at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon and it's useful for at least 30 more hours or so. The Oscars are on at 4 p.m. Pacific time. But yeah, I will say it was something I am glad I did, and I'm glad I did it on a year that was a very strong year for film. 2023 was a very strong year for the output of film, like whether it be the studios or the independents or internationally. This was one of the strongest years I've ever been aware of, at least in my lifetime. I mean, it kind of worked out great. Unintentionally, this theme actually came to me late in the game. I changed what this month was going to be to this one because I thought it would be a fun challenge, and it's a challenge. But it was a pleasure is the best way to put this. It was a pleasure to do. I enjoyed the experience because it gave me a glimpse at films that I don't tend to go see because it's films that tend to be a little bit more Hollywood centric. They're easier to see. They're more commercial. I park on it all the time, but I'm guilty of not going and seeing too many independent films in the theaters, even though those are probably the ones you should be patronizing in the theaters if we would like to have movie theaters around in 5 years. What I did gain from this, I feel very inspired. I really was just so in awe about how varied this industry truly is, even though if you're only looking at Hollywood films, it doesn't always feel that way. I also got an experience going to movie theaters I don't normally patronize. Like I was in Santa Monica. I'd never go to Santa Monica to go see movies. I usually stick up to the area where I live, which isn't Santa Monica. Spoiler alert. I'm still glad I did it. I'm glad I did it. It was a great experience. It's a unique experience living in a big city, especially one that is obviously a movie town. So they were going to be available. But in all, I'm rambling at this point. I'm so sorry. At this point, it was a great experience and a reminder as to why I absolutely love film and I will hold on to it because I physically don't think I can do that again. I got lucky that I'd already seen the Best Picture nominees because it came out of that. But if I hadn't seen all the Best Picture nominees, this would not have happened. All right. My Criterion Collection watch of this week is Spine number 334, which is Harlan County, USA. This film is an essential documentary. I could not get enough of documentaries this week, I guess, about a group of miners and their families who go on strike to get a major mining company that these men worked for to acknowledge their union. The documentary covers all sides of the issue, interviews people on both sides of the lines, and all individuals involved, whether peripherally or directly on the picket lines. It's a powerful look at a fight between the working class and a heartless corporation and the struggle of these men just to be treated like human beings. And can I please not die of a horrific, horrific lung disease? Highly recommend. And now let's get on to this week's topic. Now that I've done the longest intro I've ever done. Well, pre-edited, it's probably shorter. This week, it was the best year ever, 1962. With that, let's take our places. It's showtime.
Colonel Brighton means to put my men under European officers, does he not?
In effect, my lord, yes.
And I must do it because the Turks have European guns. But I fear to do it. On my soul, I do. The English have a great hunger for desolate places. I fear they hunger for Arabia.
Then you must deny it to them.
You are an Englishman. Are you not loyal to England?
To England and to other things.
To England and Arabia, both? And is that possible? I think you are another of these desert-loving English. That is, stand up. A Gordon of Khartoum. No Arab loves the desert. We love water and green trees. There's nothing in the desert. No man needs nothing.
22 years have passed since 1939, and the world has been through it. World War II came to a close, the Korean War happened, and the Cold War is now in full swing. In 1961, John F. Kennedy became the president, and the following year, our year 1962, he vowed to put a man on the moon before the end of the decade. JFK will not live to see that promise come to fruition. The Berlin Wall was also built in 1961, the Bay of Pigs invasion failed, and the Ken doll hit the market. The civil rights movement was in its sixth year with no end in sight. It had also been a few rough years for Hollywood. Since 1939, Hollywood studios had their theaters taken away, the government all up in their business because of the second Red Scare and all that McCarthyism shit. And of course, TV was messing up all the movie money because back then, as it is now, people more often than not preferred to be entertained in their own homes than put on pants and leave the house to do so. Infrastructure-wise, the aging movie moguls who built Hollywood were tired or retired, and so were the films their current and former studios were putting out. When the clock struck midnight on January 1, 1962, only Jack Warner and Walt Disney still had control over their studios. Also on their way out were the directors of the Golden Age, who were either retired from the job or retired from life. Died. They were dead now. So were many of the stars of that bygone era. That's how time works. But the loss of talent and the lack of a fostered new generation was causing chaos in the industry's film output. In a sign of things to come, MCA finalized a deal that saw it buying Universal Pictures, the first but definitely not the last Hollywood studio to become owned by a corporation. After the HUAC trials that blacklisted hundreds of Hollywood artisans, a decade of quote-unquote safe films had followed, devoid of a lot of controversy or the risque, lest the government return and start pointing fingers and ruining lives again. But, at long last, the Hays Code, the guidelines that had censored films for nearly 30 years, was on its way out. It was decided in 1959 that a national censorship board was in fact unconstitutional. This would open the door for more body content to be produced in Hollywood. Not all states accepted this ruling right away, as many, namely Ohio, fought to keep their rights to censor films as they saw fit. For people confused by stuff like amendments and things, that is what an actual violation of the First Amendment is. You, a government organization, are not allowing something made by a person to be screened. If it's a theater by theater basis, that's fine. That's your choice. But the government is not allowed to do that for you. That is what a First Amendment violation is. The case would go to the Supreme Court, and censorship of any kind was fully struck down in 1964. But back here in 1962, it was more or less gone, save for a few pockets of the country. You can probably guess which ones. Hasn't changed much. It's changed, but not much. Black and white cinema was also fading, and this year would be the last time that a majority of films released in the States would be without color. A change was also on the horizon. A new Hollywood was dawning, and so was an international market that at times could rival the endless musicals, period pieces, and epics coming out of the dream factories of Hollywood. In April 1962, I'm a little hoarse, I apologize, I don't know why. In April 1962, Sophia Loren became the first actress to receive the Best Actress Academy Award for a role that was not performed in English. This was for the 1961 film The Women and was a sign of things to come. If you're a regular listener of this podcast, you know that after World War II, several international cinema markets saw a massive boom in the creative output of several of their filmmakers. This led to movements that included Italian neorealism and French New Wave. Ultimately, these films would reach American shores, and several would become popular with the art house cinema scene. A few more even became national hits. Since the modesty levels were quite different in Italy or France compared to the US, American audiences would often flock to these movies because they typically showed something a little more controversial compared to what was being made in Hollywood. It felt kinda naughty, but was also entertaining and something they'd never seen before, which is, for most people, a positive thing. There was also, for the first time, ample places for films not made in Hollywood to actually have a chance at being shown in the United States. While a really bad thing for the studios, the movie theaters being independent from them meant that a multitude of different producers and production companies and international studios could now secure American screens. In all, 280 international films would see American releases in 1962, making up just under 40% of the market, one of the highest market shares international films have had in the US since the silent era. Of course, with that high of a market share, you know Hollywood's going to get involved. Several studios, including United Artists and Columbia, opened quote-unquote art divisions, which, when you know it, wouldn't have to go through the censorship board stateside to make these films because they were being made international, weakened as the censorship board was at this point. From these divisions, Hollywood could co-finance and acquire foreign films for American consumption. These films would be shot in the actors' native tongues and often dubbed in English later on. Because Americans don't like to read, which sometimes I get. I do have to be in a mood for a foreign film. That's not a judgment, that's just an observation. While they did not come out in 1962 in their respective countries, several influential films reached the American shores in 1962 and had a massive effect on current and future filmgoers and makers. This included Yojimbo from Japan, Divorce Italian Style from Italy, and Peeping Tom from the UK. Also for the second year in a row in 1962, so therefore the 1963 Oscars, the majority of the screenplay nominations at the Oscars would be for international pictures. Divorce Italian Style would win for the films of 1962. I know I've talked about this film like a few, whenever I did Italian film history, and I have seen it since. I don't know if I mentioned that part. It's been so long. I can't remember what I did 2 weeks ago. Who's Clint Eastwood? But if you don't remember, Divorce Italian Style is the insane story of a man who tries to get his wife to have an affair so he can honor kill her, which was allowed at the time, so he can marry his cousin. He falls in love with like his younger cousin. The crazy part is, this movie is a comedy, despite what I just described that movie as. The film was a social commentary of Italy at the time. It was illegal to get divorced there in the early 1960s, and Divorce Italian Style poked fun at the situation, which of course in reality is quite serious, and I'm sure many people died because of this policy. But showing the absurdity of the situation and its very real consequences was a new way of presenting manners like this, and as a result, people flocked to see something familiar while seeing something completely fresh and new. When the film released in New York in September of 1962, it set the art house world on fire. The autumn had been historically a dead time for the movie theaters and was so in 1962, and this allowed the film to reach a level of eyes that had not been seen for many international films before this. Another major release from this year from an international studio, one of the longest running franchises of all time, James Bond's first film, Dr. No. International films reaching a new generation of audience goers and filmmakers would provide a crucial injection of new blood into the film gene pool and inspire the newbies just picking up their first cameras. Within 5 years, the films coming out of Hollywood studios would in many ways more closely resemble elements of foreign films than their own films of the 1950s. To cement this era, during the Oscars celebrating 1962, Frank Sinatra would acknowledge for the first time at the ceremony that while, quote, "We think of Hollywood as the film capital of the world. We know that motion pictures are an international art." Now, let's check in on Hollywood, where shit was overall pretty bleak, despite there being quite a bit of some early experimenting happening here. Not as much as there would be in a couple of years, but this year is quite the eclectic mix of the old and new. Like last week, we're going to focus mainly on the big films of the year, with some honorable mentions sprinkled in. Also, unlike 1939, now the Oscars were awarded to the producers of the film and not the studios, which was a change that happened in 1952 for the ceremony honoring the 1951 films, but I still group them based on studios because I needed to make something about this month easier on me. I was up till 3 a.m. fact-checking this. I'm very tired. First up, poor Universal. The studio had gone through a time and a half since 1939, and just a few years ago had almost shut down for good. Like I said earlier, MCA purchased the studio this year officially after purchasing the backlot about 2 years prior for their TV show production. MCA would eventually usher in a new era for Universal, and in 13 years would basically invent the summer blockbuster. But back in 1962, as far as films went, they had a bright shining star this year critically in the form of To Kill a Mockingbird. Based on the novel of the same name, the film was a smash hit and secured Gregory Peck an Oscar win. And for the next 40 years he lived, he would claim that more people came up to him to discuss this film than any other in his very, very long storied career. If you've read the book, and if you're American, you probably had to read the book, like, what is it, freshman year of high school? Or at least at my school, but I went to Catholic school, so who knows. I don't need to tell you that this film was a biggie in its era due to its subject matter. The film dealt with racial injustice and prejudice, a hot-button issue during the civil rights era, which America was fully immersed in at this time. We're like dead center in the civil rights movement right now. While the film took place in the 1930s, it was very, very evident that the film was providing a mirror to the era in which it released, which is something that hadn't happened in a while because they were afraid of being labeled communists. The studio's biggest financial hit was like the opposite side of the coin, and that was the Doris Day Cary Grant vehicle, The Touch of Mink, which was a romantic comedy. This was an era of Day's career that saw the actress having will-they-won't-they relationships with every man on the MCA Universal roster, which by this point was growing tired with critics. Despite that, the film became the fastest to reach $1 million at a single theater. This feat occurred in 5 weeks at Radio City Music Hall in New York. In a time where the box office was struggling, this was a welcomed feat. 20th Century Fox, not faring much better. 1962 was the year that Cleopatra was being shot in Europe. We talked about that a few years ago. And was causing just all the problems. Namely, other than illness and creative shit and location and other stuff. Famously, the two stars, Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, were having a well-established affair. They were both married to other people. The film was running increasingly behind and over budget to the point that Fox was forced to cancel or pause projects indefinitely because, frankly, they had no money and had to bet everything on Cleopatra. This included what was supposed to be Marilyn Monroe's final film, Something's Got to Give, which eventually was picked back up, but Marilyn would die in August of that year, so the role was recast. Ironically enough, Fox had the biggest financial hit at the box office in 1962 in the form of the World War II epic The Longest Day. The film, shot like a documentary, covers several stories in the days following D-Day and featuring a very realistic depiction of that battle. The film was a star-studded, international-casted affair produced by Daryl F. Zanuck and greenlit by Fox in the hopes of generating some fast cash because World War II movies were still almost always a sure bet. This was the case for this film, and it made $50 million against a $7 million budget and was nominated for 5 Oscars, including Best Picture. Legacy-wise, it was the definitive movie about D-Day until 1998's Saving Private Ryan, which showed the battle in a more violent and therefore even more realistic manner. Obviously, they weren't doing anything insanely graphic in 1962. Decorum would not allow them to do so. Warner Brothers was one of the few studios in town that still had one of its original founders at the helm. In this case, it was the arguable genius and certified asshole Jack Warner. But not the Jack Warner of 1939 when we last spoke about him. This was a much older, much more out of touch Jack Warner who was still recovering from a car crash that almost killed him a few years earlier. Jack would be one of the aging moguls who would mostly refuse to adapt to the changing tastes of the American audience and instead focused on more wholesome fare like the musical The Music Man. Well, many times this would not go well. The Music Man, which was based on a stage musical, I keep saying musical a lot, which is unfortunately a side effect because of the title of this film, was a runaway hit and the third highest grossing film of the year. To this day, it remains on best musical lists of all time and was nominated for Best Picture at the Oscars. Warner smartly released the film in the summer to capitalize on the family money because the kids were on break from school and a movie is always a great way to beat the heat. Remember, this wasn't a major practice at Hollywood studios for another 13, 14 years when the summer blockbuster was developed. Not everything was wholesome, though. The studio also made Gypsy this year, another musical about the life and times of a burlesque dancer and her aggressive stage mother. Starring a grown-up Natalie Wood, the film was also one of the biggest films of the year and a much-needed success for Warner. As the description implies, it was also quite a bit more risque compared to the standard musicals of the 1950s and even into the 1960s, but it also irked some musical purists as the two leads' vocals were dubbed by stronger singers. Jack Warner would only be the head of Warner for about 5 more years after this, and was basically voluntold to retire after the failure of several films, but namely the musical Camelot. MGM, yeah, not doing great financially either. 3 years prior, with the success of Ben-Hur in 1959, MGM took on the ill-fated practice of making one massive big-budget film per year, betting that that massive big-budget film would make a shitload of money, enough that it would finance the following year's expenses and projects. In total, they went 0-for-4 on this plan, and this year's letdown, or financial letdown anyway, was their Oscar nominee for Best Picture, Mutiny on the Bounty, which was arguably the biggest flop of this practice. Well, the film was the 5th highest grossing of the year. It only made $13 million, so that gives you an idea of how bleak everything was. MGM had needed it to clear at least $30 million, making it a very, very costly flop. The film also damaged Marlon Brando's career, despite it actually being a pretty decent film, even though it's 3.5 hours long. It came out that the actor was ad-libbing nonstop on set and was just kind of being a dick, though it was Marlon Brando. I don't know why that was a surprise to anyone. Some people believe the behavior he exhibited on this set came from the disaster with his one-and-done directorial debut, One-Eyed Jax, but people were kind of over him at this point, and bad behavior was not something that he needed on his CV if he wanted to keep working. The One-Eyed Jack experience had made him salty, and he apparently wasn't even trying to be professional. The film was also prohibitively expensive as it was shot on location and was being written extensively as shooting commenced. Not rewritten, written. That's right, this film was greenlit without a full script. I say that doesn't happen anymore, and I can't tell you what film I know it was, but a major studio did this in the last couple of years, and it blew my mind. I did not know people got away with that shit anymore. At least not at major studios. Probably like A24 might let that happen if it's the right auteur. When the film released, Brando's performance was destroyed by critics, but somehow was nominated for Best Picture, as critics overall did like it. They just really hated Brando. Think like Russell Crowe in Les Mis like 11 years ago, 12 years ago. Oh God, time is not real. When, you know, it was an overall decent movie, but just that one performance was just like, Jesus, what happened? It was basically that, but Mutiny on the Bounty. Brando would claim that he acted the way he did on set because the set was unprofessional, and it was, but he was the one making it unprofessional. But enough people had worked with Brando by this point to know who he was and what his whole vibe was and be like, dude, it was probably you. The financial loss of Mutiny on the Bounty actually led to several of the MGM executives resigning, despite the professional acclaim that the film received. Paramount Pictures had just bore the brunt of the court case that split the theaters from the studios, and now a decade later, they were still struggling. The studio made just 15 films in 1962, down from the dozens they had made per year a decade earlier. As television became popular, the studio sold off the rights to its pre-1950s films this year to MCA to run on television, as back then they saw no use for them beyond that and couldn't fathom a world where that decision would come back and bite them in the ass. One thing Paramount did smartly do was adapt to television far earlier than most of the other studios did. This would eventually help rise them out of financial ruin later on in the decade. The studio's biggest hit film for the year was a film I've actually never heard of, so I'm guessing the majority of you probably haven't either. I could totally be wrong, but that is my assumption. It was called Hatari, with an exclamation point at the end, and was about a professional game hunter in Africa and starred John Wayne. So something that likely didn't age super great, I'm assuming. I'm assuming a lot right now. The film was directed by a very, very old Howard Hawks, who of course had been one of the huge directors of the 30s on, and is mostly remembered for its soundtrack. Another early adapter to TV was Disney, which was still being led by Walt Disney at this point, though not for much longer, which also cornered the market on family entertainment films. So they were doing pretty okay right now. Animation-wise, the studio had struggled to see a financial hit that would flush the studio with cash and acclaim in the way that 1937's hit Snow White and the Seven Dwarves had. But overall, everything was pretty okay over at Disney because they were making decent live-action things. The studio's output at this time was on par with what it had been in the 1950s, which was more than most Hollywood studios could say at this time. It wasn't as many, it was 5 or 6 a year, but they were a much smaller studio compared to like a Paramount or a Universal or a Warner or even a Columbia back then. They were small, but they were mighty. Disney had 2 major hits in 1962 that topped the box office at the end of the year. Or not the top, but they were in the top 10. There was Bon Voyage, which was a family road trip film. And also In Search of the Castaways, which starred Haley Mills, one of Disney's live-action darlings at the time. Columbia's head, Harry Cohn, had died 4 years earlier of a sudden heart attack, and his nephew died the following year, leading to a Cohn-less new management taking control of the studio for the first time since its foundation. The new regime would spend the rest of the decade trying to figure out what Columbia looked like without a Cohn at the helm. One of their early successes was the film Lawrence of Arabia, which was a bright shining star of the major studio films of 1962 and the second highest grossing film of the year. The film is based on the life of T.E. Lawrence, an army officer and diplomat. Attempts have been made over the years to get a film about Lawrence on screen. He was a real dude, and this was the first one to succeed. Despite some, let's say, outdated casting choices and an over 3.5 hour runtime counting intermissions and overture upon its initial release, Lawrence of Arabia won the Best Picture Oscar and 6 others. The film served as a visual inspiration for a new era of filmmakers that were on the horizon. Now, since we've talked about the foreign film stuff probably about 15, 20 minutes ago now, this is going to be a long episode, things haven't been super great overall, have they? The films have been pretty great, but financially, it's not been great. It kind of makes this seem like an unlikely candidate for a quote-unquote best year of film, because shouldn't everything in the industry be going well for something to be considered the best? Well, after researching this, because I did pick this year off of a list and I was confused when I started researching, now having done this research and sat with it for the last couple of weeks, I think that the argument laid out by film historians about this year being one of the best because of what came out of it makes it a worthy contender. Because what came out of the studio's hunger for success and the market's absence of relatable art for the newest generation reaching adulthood ushered in one of the most unique eras of Hollywood. Hints of what were to come were on full display in 1962 as well. All of these films we mentioned so far today were inspiring a new generation of filmmakers that were about to come into their own. The baby boomers were no longer babies, and having not been scarred by 2 world wars, a depression, and whatever the hell else the greatest generation had to abide in their youth, Spanish flu, wanted anything but the cinematic flair of their parents. They were very disillusioned by society as a whole anyway. The desperation of the studios during this period to attract the boomers, non-derogatory, grew despite the fact that the films they were making weren't necessarily bad. In fact, many of them stylistically were quite good. The 17-year-olds just couldn't be bothered. They had money, they had spending money, but the studios couldn't figure out how to get them to go and spend it on them, leading to a lot of very expensive films flopping despite them actually being quite good in quality. Ultimately, this led to forced innovation and risk-taking on the studio's part, allowing greater control by a new generation of directors and producers. Who better to make the content for the next generation but representatives from that age? What shook out was a mixture of at least 3 worlds. You had the resources of the big studios, combined with the unique new storytellings coming from other countries, and you had this new generation of filmmakers who wanted to make movies basically in the complete opposite way that had been ever done before. They got rid of story structures, visual styles. They brought in new acting talent. It was just a breath of fresh air that ended up happening. And most of these people that were entering the film industry at this point, they were college educated. They were very bright. And this led to a more heightened kind of entertainment because it reflected what was being taught in the schools and this new world where they could get knowledge beyond just what happened like in their neighborhoods growing up. The studios as a whole would kind of throw money at these people and say, come back with a film, because they didn't know what was going on. They didn't know what was being made. They didn't get it. Most of them didn't even like what was being made. But what they did understand was the money that was coming in. Jack Warner historically did not like Bonnie and Clyde. But when Bonnie and Clyde brought in a shitload of money, Jack Warner was pretty pleased. He was still Jack Warner, but he was happier than he'd been without the Bonnie and Clyde money. But even before this became a major practice, this happened a little bit later on in the decade, like in the mid 60s, there were already signs of this starting to happen in 1962. United Artists was another adapter to television, and in the 60s was having a pretty fruitful era, at least compared to the others. West Side Story had earned the studio a Best Picture win during the 1962 Oscars for the 1961 films. The studio would also be a major hub for the next era of Hollywood that was on the horizon. One of the films that did that was John Frankenheimer's The Manchurian Candidate, which was a surprisingly humorous political thriller about an American POW in the Korean War who is brainwashed into becoming an unwitting assassin for an international communist conspiracy. United Artists had actually been very antsy to finance this project, as a major part of the story involves assassinating the U.S. president, something that would actually happen the following year. Frank Sinatra, the star and also a producer of the film, was friendly with the Kennedy family and actually got JFK's blessing to proceed with making the film. Ironically enough, JFK was a big fan of the book on which The Manchurian Candidate is based. While it didn't set the world on fire initially, critics took notice of this very different film. It was also a major catalyst for people believing MKUltra conspiracies, but nothing's perfect. United Artists also released The Miracle Worker in 1962, a fictionalized account of the life of Anne Sullivan and her work with a deaf and blind girl, Helen Keller. Based on the stage play, which I believe was based on a book, UA had originally wanted bigger stars to play the two lead roles, but director Arthur Penn campaigned for the two actresses who originated the roles on Broadway, Anne Bancroft and Patty Duke, to reprise their characters for the film. UA ultimately agreed, but cut the film's budget in half. The Miracle Worker was unique in this year's studio's outputs because, not unlike Manchurian to a certain degree, it deals extensively with the human psyche and features very realistic-looking fights between the film's two stars. It was also unique in this year in that two women were the leads of the film. For the last several years, the industry's films had been incredibly male-dominated because of period war pieces, World War II films, and westerns. The film would also see both of its actresses unexpectedly winning Oscars for their portrayals. Produced by the independent production company Seven Arts, after every other major Hollywood studio said no thank you, and ultimately distributed by MGM, another film that challenged the failing formulaic output of Hollywood was directed by an up-and-comer named Stanley Kubrick. Lolita was a film that could only exist because the Hays Code was no longer in control of censoring Hollywood films. If you don't know, Lolita is about a middle-aged college professor who becomes infatuated with a 14-year-old girl. The tone of this film is outwardly sexual, a complete departure from a film like The Touch of Mink, in which the sexy is just heavily implied. I doubt I need to tell you that this film was insanely controversial when it released in 1962. Many religious groups, knowing the book on which this film is based, loosely based, but based, sent letters to Kubrick trying to get him to cancel the project, but we're talking about it, so you know how that went. You know a film is controversial when 62 years have passed, and it's still considered insanely controversial. But the film was unique with its balance of humor and melancholy, and critics at the time didn't really know what to do with that, or this film in general. Neither did the older, more conservative members of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. This film was also one of the first times that word of mouth caused a film to gain popularity. Another Seven Arts financed project was Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, and that film was ultimately distributed by Warner Brothers. The film starred two actresses once at the top of the Hollywood pile, whom had fallen out of the spotlight mostly due to their age. That was Joan Crawford and Bette Davis. For years, these two were struggling to find roles. Also, they had a famous rivalry betwixt the two, you're probably aware of. And director Robert Aldrich thought it would be a good idea to put them on set together to make a movie. Alleged chaos ensued. I have an episode about it. You can check out what happened there through that. While the film was positively panned by critics, but a little bit more towards neutral, the film did financially well enough that it would kick off a genre known as hagsploitation, which had a short run in popularity featuring other actresses from the golden age going ham on people. The film is now considered a quote-unquote camp classic thanks to its exaggerated performances, dark humor, and foreboding mise-en-scene that kind of serves as a metaphor for a past-its-prime Hollywood. With all of this, it was kind of hard not to notice, while researching this episode, the parallels between 1962 and the state of Hollywood in 2024. Hollywood just had one of its better output years in a minute last year, but still the box office is not reflecting that as it didn't in 1962. We've also got, at several studios, several either out of touch or tired studio heads who are incapable or unable to put out the type of movies that people will go see. You know that if a film about a goddamn bear doing cocaine for almost 2 hours does a decent job at the box office, that people are yearning for something new. We've also got an aging talent problem, but this time it tends to be just a little bit more behind the camera. New talent seems to be doing pretty okay in front of it. Ironically, a lot of the people causing that problem were the people who fixed Hollywood 60 years ago. Which brings up the question, when does gratitude for what you did for the industry wear out? Arguably, the filmmakers still working from 1962 era, the 60s era, are past their prime, but are still taking up a lot of resources in the name of name recognition, despite a younger audience clearly yearning for something else. While it's a great film, Killers of the Flower Moon took a year to shoot and millions of dollars and resources from two studios, Apple and Paramount. Paramount had the rights and eventually Apple gave them to Apple, sold them to Apple, only for it to be a financial flop, more or less. Apple can say they made a Scorsese film, but does that have the weight it did 30, 40 years ago? I don't think so. I'm not saying this film shouldn't have been made, but was Martin Scorsese even the director who needed to make it at all? Was there anything unique about this film and its storytelling that couldn't have been done for cheaper by a different director? After going through all of this week, I think sometimes the best year is because of what came out of it, and sometimes you have to burn something down to build it back up. Let 1962 provide a lesson for what film can be. It can embrace the old while taking risks on the new. Yes, the olds need to work, but eventually they'll be gone. And what do we do if there's no one sufficiently trained to take their place? What if 1962 was the best year ever, not because of the films that were released? What if it was the best year ever because it led to a hunger within the film industry that caused a rapid expansion of talent, of types of stories being told, and of course the technological advancements that occurred so these kinds of stories could be adequately told? Why don't we here in 2024, 62 years removed from this time, look at 1962 as a possibility of what could happen now if the right choices are made? Right now, the film industry is on the precipice of change, not unlike it was back in 1962. It's just this time we've got the streaming wars, we've got AI, we've got the phones, we've got shortened attention spans. There's a lot of stuff changing film, but that was the case back then, and it was the case before that in different eras. We just need to find the new way to tell stories. Maybe someday, some other weird film nerd in her 30s decides during a different pandemic to make a podcast about film, and one day decides to do a podcast about the best years of film ever, and looks back and decides that, you know what, maybe 2023, 2024, like 1962, was the best year ever because of the foundation it provided for what came next. 1962 was the year that showed that film could and should endure, and a promising look about what film could and should be. By the end of the decade, a new generation of filmmakers would inject the industry with new ideas that would see an increase in audiences and therefore the box office. This would not last, of course, but right now, it was 1962, and it was the best year ever.
I was just wondering who all those people were at the back door.
Wasn't anything. Just that nosy Mrs. Bates going on about your picture last night.
Oh, really? Did she like it?
She liked it.
I remember when it first came out, it got a tremendous reception. The critics described it as brilliant.
Do you remember what year you made that picture?
But of course. You must, too, 1934, right after I did Moonglow.
I made a picture that year, too.
Oh, yes. It was that comedy directed by Lloyd, wasn't it?
No, it wasn't. It was a love story. The Longest Night. Marty McDonald said it was the best thing I ever did. They never even released it in the United States.
Feldman was very upset. He told me the company had a very bad year, and they couldn't afford...
No, they didn't. They had a great year. They didn't want to show my film. They were too busy giving a big build-up to that crap you were turning out.
And that's going to do it for this week. This is over an hour raw audio, because I stuttered a lot. Hopefully it's not that long. I did not realize I had that much to say. If there's anything you'd like me to cover in the future, please reach out on social media where I also post photos for each episode at Tinsel Factory Pod on Instagram, on Facebook at The Tinsel Factory, or you can always email me at tinselfactorypod@gmail.com. If you have emailed me in the last couple of weeks, I am forgetting to do that quite a bit. I should probably do that. I've got a Letterboxd account which features my watch lists, film diary, and recommended viewing from this episode. You can check it out at the link in the show notes. I'm relying on word of mouth to get this podcast out there, so if you can please rate, review, and subscribe so that other people can find this podcast, that would be a huge help and very much appreciated. In order to keep making the podcast, I've also set up a support page, the link of which you can find in the show notes. If you'd like to help out in any way, I'd very much appreciate it. I've also got the Buy Me a Coffee, where you buy me a coffee. I had cold brew because I've been up since 7 a.m. finishing the script because I fell asleep on my laptop last night. I'm very tired. I've also got merch. Check it out, the link in the show notes. Next week, we're doing a year that was not the originally planned year, but was requested by my good friend Barlack. And it was on the stretch list. Next week, it was 1984, and it was the best year ever. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, that's a wrap.